Happy Death to Tyrants Day, all of you out there on social media and in our webinar today. The Running Into the Fog podcast with the Johnson Brothers is live on March 15th. How are the Ides of March treating you today, Derek?
So far, so good. I'm after this podcast ends, I'm finishing packing, and I'm going to Wisconsin Dells and a water park with my kids. So if I haven't encountered any tyrants yet today, I'm probably about to. And we'll see how that goes for me.
Speaking of the opposite of tyrants, by the way, these are two of the finest gentlemen I happen to know and two of my closest friends, not only from the intelligence world, but from the world in general. I'd like to introduce you once again to my good buddy, Eric Garland. Mr. Garland, Six Emperor Tyrannus, buddy.
Six Emperor Tyrannus, sir.
Stream today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to talk with you guys. Miss you guys.
Fantastic. And last but not least, Mr. Tom Tao, actually Professor Tom Tao, excuse me, Professor. Welcome, Tom. How are you today?
Very good. Just came out of class, so I didn't get the chance to wear anything special for you guys.
No worries. Well, I was going to say, is that the Temple of Heaven over your left shoulder there? It looks like you're in Beijing.
Well, no, this is UD. We have a similar style of
it kind of looks like the Temple of Heaven, doesn't it? From the top.
It does.
Well, the center of the universe, if I'm not mistaken. I've stood there a few times over the few trips I've been to China, but I'm so glad you guys are here with Derek and I today. All of you in the audience, Six Emperor Tyrannus to you all, thus always unto tyrants, as we say on this very special day. I know for many people, you might find it weird that Death to Tyrants Day is my favorite holiday, but that's just the kind of person I am. And, you know, Derek, Tom, and Eric know the story behind that. I wore my Julius Caesar dead skull shirt today. He came, he saw, and he conquered, and then he got killed. And as you see on the screen I'm sharing here, that's really where the saying comes from. Six Emperor Tyrannus is the Latin for thus always unto tyrants, that it might be so. And, you know, that's the one thing I think all tyrants have in common is that they all end up dead in the end, which is sort of why this is such a special day. They all get it. They all receive justice eventually. I want to kind of kick this off with a couple of stories. If you brought your favorite tyrant example today, let us know in the chat. Chat is a lively place for the folks on the webinar. If you're not on the webinar, you need to hustle on over here to openrecon.com. This website is where you can register and join. Use this little button up here, RITF, at the top. And if you click on that, it'll take you to a place where you can register and join us. The second half of our show is audience participation. We essentially outsource the conversation to our audience, but you got to be on the Zoom webinar in order to do that. So those of you who are on the Zoom webinar, start lining up as interlocutors. If we have more than three, fantastic, but we're going to try and kind of stay on schedule so we can get Derek and his children to the water park on time. But I had a couple of notes before we start, and I've got a little trilogy of stories here to share with you. I won't make you listen to me entirely while we go, but before I start, I want to draw your attention to this specific object, which you may notice on your screen is the POAP for today. Unthinkable. That's a QR code that you should scan and redeem that POAP. It's a Web3 NFT token that gives you access to privileges in the future. So scan it, save it, put it in your wallet. We'll have some benefits for you as a result of doing that. As I was saying, we've got a few different ideas to work through here today. Of course, the original example from 44 BC, Brutus, you can see in the little inset graphic there is laying the blade to Julius Caesar. After he was prophesied to that he should beware the Ides of March, there's something about the middle of March that's just always kind of been sort of spooky for people, especially tyrants. But Julius Caesar is not my favorite tyrant. My favorite Roman tyrant actually is Nero. And the reason for that is that Nero was actually a pretty average guy until he murdered his mother, Agrippina. And when he murdered his mother, he kind of went off the deep end, which can tend to happen But, you know, that was very tyranty. That was a very tyranty thing to do, I would say. Don't murder your mother, everyone who's watching. But you can see here the reference. Forgive me for using Wikipedia. I know it's debatable how accurate Wikipedia is these days. But Nero abandoned the restraint he had previously shown because he believed a course supporting the Senate promised to be less and less profitable. And that's really the story of all tyrants. And after I use my Nero example here, I'm going to kind of open it up for any examples that Mr. Garland or Mr. Tao may have brought along with them, or Derek. I know you're not as into tyrants as I am, but if you brought one, great. Maybe your tyrant is the children you're going to take to the water park today. They can be kind of tyrannical sometimes. But I would recommend against matricide under all circumstances, lest such a fate fall unto you. So with that, Tom, Eric, do you guys have a favorite tyrant you'd like to share with our audience today?
Well, I do have one. He is, I guess, the first tyrant that's registered in the Chinese history. And his name is Qin Shi Huang. He's really is the one that's unified entire China by eliminating the six other sort of smaller countries in the entire continent at the time. And he was the first one who really created an empire in China. Mm-hmm. Previously, it has always been fragmented, and there was a lot of wars and fights. But he is the first one who unified the entire country, and he certainly creates a very centralized power, and create the entire bureaucratic system. Has the one currency, one language, and he loves to build up grand projects. Certainly, the Great Wall was his product. And the terracotta soldiers was also his creation. The other things that he have done is certainly come to a lot of central planning and visible hands in controlling the economy. And he's also quite charismatic. I guess it's one of the characteristics of many tyrants, can really rally the troop. The other thing is he has created a police state institute, a lot of spies on its own people, and somewhat of an initial form of surveillance state too. And certainly no arms for the people. And he has collected all the weapons from all the people and melt those metal weapons into, I think, 12 large statues, and so that nobody can fight him. But at the end of the day, and he also killed a lot of intellectuals because they're gonna try to spread news on other thoughts. And so he's famous for many of these things. But eventually, the empire he built up didn't last too long as he planned. It collapsed almost the very second that he died. And his son was inheriting that, and it just didn't last too long. The entire system just collapsed on that very moment that he really was sick and died.
Highlighting, I think, one of the frailties of tyranny, which is poor succession planning, I think, tends to be a characteristic of tyrants. And as you think of sort of, I guess Stalin probably did it a little better with Khrushchev than Hitler did. But as contemporaries, I'd say, you know, circumstances were a little bit different there. But Eric, fantastic example, by the way. I believe I was, is there a museum to Qin at the Great Wall at Ba Da Ling? I think I toured a museum to him there, north of Beijing, way back in the day.
There are quite a few museums about him, but I think the biggest one is still in Xi'an, or the old Chang'an, the old capital of Qin. It will be, if there is one, that's the most comprehensive one.
Of course, the last time I was in Xi'an, I was there with you. So walking along the wall and drinking, we drank tea all day, as I recall. It's been a Saturday tea.
Absolutely.
Fantastic example, Tom. Thank you. Eric, what do you bring to the party here today, buddy?
I got a curveball here. Shaka Zulu.
Shaka Zulu, nice.
You guys didn't see that one coming.
Didn't normally think of him as a tyrant, but I can't wait to hear about it.
Oh, so of course, you know, he created a military empire by evolving mostly military tactics. The Wisa, the short spear, and the smaller shield, as opposed to some of the other, the larger spear weapons. And, you know, he invented the horns and the flank, the chest and the horns. That was it. So he had battle tactics that Napoleon ended up mimicking, and that brought him to really, you know, local imperial status. In response to the incursions of Europeans, and he was incredibly fearsome, but he ended badly. He was increasingly, nasty with the people, but when his mother died, he went bananas. If you've never looked at this, he was in such grief. He demanded that the entire nation grieve with him. And when he decided that they weren't showing sufficient sadness, he did things like murder every pregnant woman in the empire and the husbands, and then sent his armies off to fight unnecessary wars. And when they would come back with, you know, bruised in battle, he would send them out to fight again, and they murked him. They killed him. They're like, all right, we're done. We're done. 1827, I believe. So six Semper Tyrannus, like the murder, like we... They like the murdering all the pregnant women in any country, probably not gonna go well. So
wow, what a great example. I'm impressed with that one as well. I love this little tour around the world we're doing of tyrants. We go from Rome to ancient China to, you know, the sort of industrial age Africa. And Derek, I noted your chat remark there, that your observation that today is corporate tax deadline day. So that, I suppose, the corporate income tax regime, that's a form of tyranny, I suppose. I don't know. Are we going to get our stream canceled if I say that out loud?
Well, maybe we'll just claim that the Internal Revenue Service is a different form of tyranny. That might be what I'm trying to suggest.
Canceled. Nobody likes paying taxes. So that's a broadly held, that's a democratic value. Nobody likes
that is true.
Nobody likes it.
That is
true. I can remember a time as kids where I kind of thought you were a bit of a tyrant. Sure. You know, maybe there'll be time for a story or two in that regard in the second half of our hour.
I had some of it. That is in my nature, I will say. It is something I do some battle with myself. And that's probably why I love the day so much, is that sort of every day I have to slaughter my inner tyrant, slit his throat, you know, and sort of die in that way and try and put others' interests ahead of my own, which is actually the perfect segue, Derek. And incidentally, the S Corporation was invented for March 15th, I believe, because... S corporations don't actually pay income taxes, the shareholders do. It flows on through to your K-1. Those of you who've set up an S corp in the past, I would like to share with you one of the traits, in addition to poor success, succession planning, I think there's another trait that tyrants have in common, and that is narcissistic personality disorder. Mm-hmm. Sort of think about some of the characteristics in the DSM-5 down below here. A grandiose sense of self-importance, preoccupation with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love, believing that they are special and unique and can only be understood or should associate with other special or high status people or institutions. Requires excessive admiration. Know anybody like that today? A sense of entitlement, being interpersonally exploitative, lacking empathy, envious of others, believing others are envious of them, and showing arrogant, haughty behaviors or attitudes. The floor is open, gentlemen. Any names come to mind, or reactions to the narcissism?
We could talk about DSM-5 stuff all day, but I was just thinking with the broad range of time scale that when we brought up our examples of tyranny, We went back all the way to Emperor Qin. We go up to the 19th century Shaka, or we're stopping by, you know, the year 64 or whatever it was, for 64 BC, for somewhere in there, for 80. Julius Caesar.
They were 80 for Nero. Yep. Julius Caesar was 44.
Okay. So, and you were saying, yeah, I have to put down my inner tyrant in order to make good decisions. I think this is a universal universal characteristic of leadership when human beings are doing the leading, is that, you know, when you know, tyranny is really a small group of people decide, to the exclusion of all other factors, that they are going to put their specific needs ahead of pretty much everyone else's, right? And as intelligence professionals, we have to deal with leaders, and we almost always deal with people who have pretty large egos, which they have to, especially if you're doing, you know, if you're making really serious decisions where people can live or die, talking about the wealth and prosperity and happiness of nations, right down to the, you know, whether it's micro level or macro level, you know, if you have other people depending on you, which is, that's the definition of a leader, right? You know, you've got a lot of weight on your shoulders. And so to deal with that, everyone needs, you know, a pretty healthy ego. And the higher you go up in some of these social systems, you know, you may have to make a decision where somebody gets hurt as a result of your decision. And there's no way around it. Some bad things happen to human beings in the world. And you're going to make a decision, and, you know, you're going to be responsible for some of that. So you have to have a certain amount of, you know, narcissism to believe that you're better than everybody else at making this decision. Sure. You know, I do have sort of an elitist point of view, and when it comes to leadership, I don't think everyone's cut out for leadership. I don't think the madness of crowds I don't think crowdsourcing makes for great leadership. It can make, you know, it can be insightful, and we, you know, want to listen to lots of people, but the madness of crowds, I think, is just. But there is a fine line there where you kick over into, all right, so these decisions are on me, and really I'm the only one who really knows quite the scale of them. And that may be true, but when that goes over to, and so I'll do whatever I want, and I don't want to hear you complaining. In fact, if anyone's complaining about this, it's because they don't really appreciate how wonderful I am. And that's when you get that lack of empathy and the the grandiosity may be the situation. Right. We're not talking now. If you're talking about somebody at a, you know, as an average, you know, person working in a grocery store who believes they're Julius Caesar, you know, that's considered delusional, right? That's a level of grandiosity that's clinical. You have grandiosity, like if you're, you know, if you're Deputy Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon, you have a sense of grandiosity because you're in charge of, you know, putting warheads on foreheads, and people under you may die, and you may die. I mean, it's a grandiose operation. So, like, basically, leadership kind of invites a certain, like, you walking up towards the line of some clinical type issues with everybody we're going to work with or for. So I think that's true too with our democracies, where we want people who are decisive, but we don't want them to forget who they are or who we are, and not care about the suffering of people anymore. And I, you know, since we're talking about this with a 3,000 year time scale, thanks to Tom, this seems pretty universal, and it seems perennial.
It is true, absolutely. It's in our human natures. And given the chance, we will have someone who's going to emerge as the leader, and who also, once they are maybe very successful, they will grow in their confidence, and they will emerge as the tyrant, should all the other conditions starting to mature. We've seen that plenty of examples in, say, Lord of the Flies or even The Walking Dead, right? You're starting to see those leader emerge as a somewhat of a tyrannic position. But I think what we have seen in the U.S. Maybe 200 years ago, with the Constitution, is designed to somewhat control that, right? To prevent the emergence of a tyrant, with check and balance, with the three powers. But we certainly are also seeing some of those principles being challenged lately. And that's really mm-hmm. concerning.
Yeah.
Amen to that. Derek, do you have any thoughts there? And then I've got a couple quotes I want to share from one of my favorite books that I'll share with you in the bibliography here in a second.
Yeah, I'll just say, and Eric, you and I have talked about the name I'm about to put on the table here. I think it was a couple chapters ago in our book writing process, which is a bit unique. We had our ghostwriter Wanda on a few episodes ago. The name is
Wanda, the friendly ghostwriter.
Casper, the friendly ghostwriter.
Yeah.
Tony Robbins. We write about Tony Robbins in this book, and when I think of somebody being a tyrant, I'm gonna interpret a little bit of what Eric and Tom and you have said in the sense that narcissism means you're putting your own interests ahead of that of another person or group of persons for some type of personal gain. And a more recent example might be, and we don't know all the implications of this, but the Silicon Valley Bank CEO that sold $3.5 million worth of stock a couple of weeks ago, ahead of that collapse. I'm not projecting that I know anything at all about that scenario, but in Tony Robbins's world, he's going to try to help you convince yourself that there is more control of your own destiny type of mindset to be had out there. And why are you feeding the man, so to speak, when you could be the man and, go into this coaching capability that he's got all the tools and access and everything else. And I think we wrote about him or intend to in context of chapter 6 on humility, if I have it right. So, anyone that lacks humility.
Which incidentally is sort of the antidote for narcissism in many ways, that putting others' interests ahead of your own. Let me read you a couple things in response to that, Derek. This one is the character O'Brien in George Orwell's 1984. And by the way, these quotes are all taken from the fine work of Andrew Lobachevsky in his 2005 book, Political Ponerology, which is the science of evil, psychopathy, and the origins of totalitarianism. And it's quite a read. Power is not a means, it is an end. One does not establish a dictatorship to safeguard a revolution. One makes the revolution in order to establish the dictatorship. And now let that simmer for a second when I read you the second one, which is Frank Herbert in his book, Chapter House Dune, and Dune fans. This is the Missionaria Protectiva. All governments suffer a recurring problem. Power attracts pathological personalities. It is not that power corrupts, but that it is magnetic to the corruptible. Such people have a tendency to become drunk on violence, a condition to which they are quickly addicted. How you like that one? Mm. And then the coup de grace from Monsieur Alexis de Tocqueville in the Recollections on the French Revolution. I have always thought that in revolutions, especially democratic revolutions, madmen, not those so-called by courtesy, but genuine madmen, have played a very considerable political part. One thing is certain, and that is that a condition of semi-madness is not unbecoming at such times, and often even leads to success. Read this book. If you're interested in tyranny, it's irreplaceable. And the floor is open, and before that, I do that, excellent comments in the chat, everyone. Terry Thiel, you're on deck to join this so far fellows heavy conversation about Death to Tyrants Day. We need some other volunteers to join the back half because we're going to cut social loose in about 6 or 7 minutes. So if you want to join the panel and jump on and talk about all this stuff, raise your hand. All right, floor's open, guys.
With regards to March 15th, are people aware of the significance of that in the Roman calendar?
Please.
And it plays to why it's corporate tax day. It was the Ides of March were when you settled up your debts because the old Roman system, the new year is April 1st, right?
Oh, sure.
April Fool's Day is the old calendar.
Mm.
That's when the planting begins again. And, you know, this is a pre-financialized world. So, you know, this is why usury and multiple year deals were considered. That's why most of the Western religions forbid usury, because most of the wealth is agriculturally based, right? And if you're holding someone to there's no 5 or 10 year mortgage in old Rome, because if you're going to hold somebody to the wealth that might be created 7 years from now, you don't know what the climate and the weather is going to be like.
Right.
You don't know what the planting season is going to be. So it was considered tyrannical to hold somebody to a multiple year deal where they had to come up with debt, you know, they had to come up with a cash flow of a certain thing for 8 solid years, 3 years or whatever. Nope. So on the third moon for us, and on the 15th day of the 11th moon for them, you settled up your debts. So it was the Ides of March, pay your debts.
Wow.
And then
I did not know that. That's great. You taught me something.
Look, well, you know, like if you think of the roads being, you know, the car being 2 horse butts wide, in, you know, in terms of like the Roman chariots and whatnot. I mean, we still have these very old structures that are still around. But I just, you know, since we're talking banking, and a lot of trouble has come from these financial systems that are opaque, they're non-transparent. A lot of these people have not been subject to the rule of law. Mm-hmm. And many of us, you know, across the world, I mean, untold millions to billions of people, you know, end up in abusive situations, you know, due to debt structures and financial, you know, structures and tax regimes. And, you know, back in the day, that wouldn't fly. You had to reset it every year. I'm not sure that's workable, but I think the principle of, you know, how we need to avoid abuse, I think that is up for discussion.
Well, and of course, let alone a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, that would, I mean, isn't that slavery, really? Indentured servitude at a minimum.
I mean, that's how the Romans thought of it.
Right.
And this is why usury was forbidden in some religious texts.
Speaking of debt, why don't we just jump into this? I have some prepared remarks on that topic, and you segued it perfectly for me. Now, if you've never read the book by G. Edward Griffin, The Creature from Jekyll Island, the Jekyll Island resort was the site of the bankers who got together and put together the Federal Reserve in 1913. And if you've ever read a history of the Federal Reserve, it's pretty interesting how the Federal Reserve was basically J.P. Morgan's idea. And we'll jump into some of this here. Maybe we'll do this during Unspeakable so that I don't get accused of injecting doubt in the banking system. So for those of you on social who are watching and enjoying this conversation, make sure you jump over to openrecon.com and register to join the bridge, or else you won't hear about the stuff I have prepared about the banking system for you. But the whole Federal Reserve banking system that really comprises how the United States manages its money supply has been the source of a lot of news over the weekend. And here now moving into this week, there's a lot going on, obviously, in that world. I'm just going to, you know, open the floor for any remarks about that before we go a little deeper on Unspeakable, the second half. Anything you guys want to touch on there with regard to that situation?
There are plenty of doubts going on the banking system beyond what you are going to say, because that's all out there already. It's not a secret. And I guess one of the things I really hate to see that is the Fed system, at least by design, it should be independent from the government. And but we've seen the loss of that independence for a long time, and the Fed has been catering to the demand of the government, and that's not independent at all. It leads to a monetary policy that's just suiting the political agenda rather than the nation's interest. So that's a very, very dangerous situation that's really putting us into these several crisis already, and we don't see any lights in the tunnel yet.
Mm-hmm. I've got another historical reference to share with you all, and this is from Investopedia. After many decades lacking a central bank, it was J.P. Morgan who ultimately forced the government into acting on the central banking plans it had been considering off and on for almost a century. During the bank panic of 1907, Wall Street turned to J.P. Morgan to steer the country through the crisis that was threatening to push the economy over the edge into a full crash and depression. Morgan was able to convene all the principal players at his mansion and command all their capital to flood the system, thus floating the banks that in turn helped to float the businesses until the panic passed. The fact that the government owed its economic survival to a private banker forced the necessary legislation to create a central bank and the Federal Reserve, which of course, 3 years later, I have for you on a different window here, some additional details about that, but I can't find it right now. So the central bank essentially was something that was always part of American history. It's always been part of a lot of countries, but we didn't have one for about 100 years. And it wasn't until J.P. Morgan had to bail out the country that he was able to apply sufficient influence to get what he wanted. And many people think of the Federal Reserve as being a government institution.
Yeah,
it's a private corporation owned by the money center banks. So, gentlemen, tear that one apart. We're going to go a little over on unthinkable, I think, by the way, just to tempt fate here a little bit, poke the tyrant a little and see if they cut us off.
You know, a lot of people don't know that about the Federal Reserve or any of this. And it's funny when you start, you know, people will throw out these terms like socialism when they're in the private sector and maybe they're high net worth individuals. And it's like, hold on. There are ample partnerships between the public sector and private sector where certain individuals, even though, you know, we're back to, you know, Animal Farm here, we're all equal, but some of us are more equal than others. These are citizens like you and I, and yet they have a deal with the U.S. Treasury that we don't get.
Mm-hmm.
That's problematic.
As George Carlin said once, it's a big club and,
you ain't in it.
Exactly.
I think what the Fed did over the weekend is going to set a pretty difficult precedent to backtrack from in the future.
Yeah, it's a lot of potential liability on the shoulder of Fed. If you're just insuring the entire depositors for one bank, why not the others? And where do you draw the line? That's going to be a major problem.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, go ahead, Eric.
I find this really useful because in 2008, when the banks all came apart, which my firm Competitive Futures predicted down to the month, well in advance, as my people who got my newsletter, it was like September, October, 2008, check it out. We were right. But once that moment hit, there was all this like hysterical panic that was, you know, that was reflected from the institutions themselves. That they benefited from that. They're like, we don't have any time. We don't have any time. You have to make this deal. You have it. We need back with nation states. Boy, do we need nation states now. And that kind of happened here with Silicon Valley Bank, but it was just them. It was sort of like the equivalent of when Will Ferrell goes streaking in Old School. Come on, we're going streaking. He's the only guy naked in the street. You know, remember that movie?
Yeah.
It's different. It's one thing when you're doing something crazy in a group of people. It's another when it's just you. And, you know, the Silicon Valley Bank, you know, you had some people on Twitter who were, you know, deeply entwined, the PayPal mafia and whatnot, who were talking about, well, you know, they were big libertarians, mind you, but boy, they wanted that bank out, or the bank bailout. And they were it was the only bank doing it. So this is not different than what happened in 2008. And those assets that got bought by the Federal Reserve, or, you know, the TARP programs and all that stuff, that is still with us. That still affects the economy. That still affects households here, you know, businesses that didn't get to launch, and people that lost their homes. It feels like a long time ago, but it's not. It's still with us. But this time we get to see it under a microscope of one bank and a lot of people that aren't especially sympathetic to Main Street folks, I think. So we get a chance now that it's a little bit slower. We get a chance to discuss this. What did we just do this past weekend? What happened there? Because China's startups depended on Silicon Valley Bank. Israel's startups depended on Silicon Valley Bank. India's startups did, but our government took action. We did the same thing in 2008, of course. But what was that? And, you know, we just have a moment to think about it for once. And I think that's pretty useful. Even if whatever we discover is outrageous, it's time to talk about some. If it's outrageous, it's outrageous, and we need to talk about it. But isn't that that's the theme of democracy, is like, hold on, you know, we do not buckle to tyrants, private individuals or people in official capacity. We don't knuckle under to that. So let's just, what are you guys doing there? So I find this an interesting moment.
You got a question actually from Sarah in Q&A. It says, so Eric, are you predicting another collapse? And if so, when?
I am not predicting another collapse. I'm predicting perhaps a reckoning. There is so much more antitrust and otherwise like financial fraud enforcement happening now versus the 2000s. It's not comparable. I like to refer to him as Gary Gensler, the barbarian, just with what the head of the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, just with what he's doing with cryptocurrency. And there was a $1 billion fraud that got charged this morning against a guy named Guo Wengi, or Miles Guo, Miles Kwok. He goes by about six different names. One of Steve Bannon's partners in the Southern District of New York. And it's a $1 billion fraud. They've already seized it at $600 million. I don't know. I don't commit financial fraud. Is a billion a lot?
Billionaire, you're talking real money.
It starts to add up. So, you know, for one dude, right? I guess a lot of this depends on this Himalaya coin, or a cryptocurrency ecosystem, I think is what the indictment said. Some of the crypto schemes I don't find, functionally dissimilar from the mortgage-backed security schemes. They just have like a more interesting cloth of blockchain, and it's getting prosecuted, and nobody was puncturing the mortgage-backed security hustles, or, you know, a credit default swap or a collective debt obligation. Nobody was busting on those in 2005 and 6 and 7. And then when the banks start going out in 08, we're like, all right, knuckleheads, and we could wrap them up. This is very different. We have been, or the U.S. government in particular, has been systematically going after and prosecuting some of these financial frauds as crimes, cognizable under 18 U.S. code felonies, and putting people, in prison for them. Left, right, and center. And that's accelerating. And that was not happening prior to 2008. So I think we're going to find way more criminality. I think we may have more nation state intervention in order to stop things from destabilizing. But I do not predict a collapse in the style of 2008, because there was nobody minding the store from attacks of September 11th. Actually, the collapse of the first .com period in the year 2000, 2001, Enron, WorldCom, the failure of Arthur Andersen, all of that stuff, which you guys remember. Between those events and the attacks of September 11th and the collapse of 2008, there was less regulation after the .com collapse of 2000, not more. And here we've got more. So I'm pretty optimistic.
Here's thank you for the question, Sarah, and the answer, Eric. You'll see on the screen M2. the money supply. And when I started getting interested in banking, which was a lot later than you, Eric, Eric's talking about the 2008 great financial crisis, GFC, right in here, this little section of the chart. That is when the money supply spiked by rather a lot. You'll notice it went from what, 2007, I got lag on my screen here. I should just watch my screen, not the, January 2008, $7,473 billion. And by, this is so silly of me. Why am I watching the Zoom screen? I should be watching my own screen. We added a trillion, it's tripled. We added $1 trillion. So now fast forward over the last decade, and you'll see here, this is COVID, by the way. COVID, what, we were at 15 and a half trillion or so. A couple months later, we were at 18 trillion. Where'd that come from? Where did we get that four extra $1 trillion? And then it went up to 20 or almost $20 trillion of M2. And on February 1st of 2021, I got really freaking interested in M2. Why? Because the Federal Reserve stopped reporting it. And I said, freaking shit. And by the way, that is going to conclude our unthinkable portion for the day. We've got Rostek Hirsky's joined us, who I didn't think was going to be able to make it today. But Rostek, glad you're here. You're going to come on in Unspeakable. For all of those of you on social media right now, I'm so sorry to say goodbye. Das vidanya to you all. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. We've got a great guest coming up then. Adam Pierno is going to be on the show talking about something. I can't remember what, but you'll get an email from us out there. But we got to say goodbye to the social folks. And then Rostek, I'm going to give the floor to you because you came here today and we're talking about tyranny. And boy, brother, there is nobody who has been forced to study tyranny like a Ukrainian in the last 13 months or so. So goodbye to you on social media.